May it please the court, good morning. I'm Jeff McPherson. It's my privilege to have been appointed to represent Mr. Goldsby in this appeal. Speaking of privileges, I hope your guests realize what a rare privilege it is to get applause from the bench. That's not the reaction I commonly get. The judgment of the circuit court should be reversed because Mr. Goldsby's petition was not barred by res judicata, a defense that was not pleaded and that was not proved. But the issue in Mr. Goldsby's transfer application and the only issue that was decided by the Court of Appeals was appellate jurisdiction, which I always say in quotes anymore since the JCW case, but it may be applicable here. It's undisputed that Mr. Goldsby's notice of appeal was timely. The issue raised by the defendant and decided by the Court of Appeals was whether a filing fee was required to be received within the time for the filing of the notice of appeal. Respectfully, Section 512.050 has no such requirement. Article 5, Section 5 of the Constitution says that this Court's rules cannot change the law relating to the right of appeal. Respectfully, the timing of the filing fee is not jurisdictional, and Mr. Goldsby's appeal should not have been dismissed. In the alternative, the appeal should not have been dismissed because the appellant did what he could do in order to comply with the filing fee requirement, if there is one. And there certainly is a filing fee requirement. I'm talking about the timeliness of the filing fee. But Mr. Goldsby was thwarted by the active interference of others, and therefore, under this Court's cases under 2915, which involve a cognate situation, the appeal should not be dismissed. If I could talk first about what in my brief is point one, section 512.050 specifies the time when a notice of appeal needs to be filed. It says what you have to do to invoke your right to appeal. You have to do it within the time, and you have to file a notice of appeal, and the statute goes on to say that the failure to do any other thing, quote, does not affect the validity of the appeal, end quote. Article 5, Section 5 says that this Court can make rules relating to practice and procedure in the courts that have the force and effect of law. There's no doubt about that. However, they cannot affect the right of appeal. Rule 8104, to the extent that it has been held to affect the right of appeal, cannot engraft onto 512.050 the requirement of a filing fee at any particular time as a matter of the validity of the appeal, as going to the jurisdiction of the court to entertain the appeal.
Is it your position, and I believe from your brief it is your position, that the court has the authority to collect the fee and the court has the authority to dismiss the appeal if the filing fee is not filed, but it cannot preclude the appeal from going forward for an untimely notice of appeal?
Your Honor, that's 100% correct. Everybody has to comply with the court's rules, but the effect of this rule of the court cannot be that you don't even get to have an appeal. And the JCA case is instructive on this. I feel like really instructive because I didn't hear anything about it in the respondent's substitute brief. The JCA case deals with another provision of Chapter 512 about the right to a trial de novo. It just says you have to file your application for a trial de novo. There's another statute that says you have to pay a filing fee. But JCA holds, A, that the filing fee is not jurisdictional because it's not part of the statute, and you couldn't impose that. And second, the filing fee is not jurisdictional because the statute doesn't say it. And third, it goes on to say that it's improper to dismiss someone for a late filing fee if the filing fee's already been paid.
And that was moving on to circuit court, right? Associate circuit court.
It was,
JCA was dealing with.
It was, Your Honor.
But you're saying the comparable principles would apply here?
The comparable principles apply here, and JCA says that the comparable principles apply here. JCA cites 512.050, the statute I'm talking with the court about this morning. It distinguishes 512.050 from the trial de novo statute because it said, as of the time that JCA was decided, that 512.050 had a filing fee requirement in it, that it had to be within the time and accompanied by a filing fee, which I think was $10 at the time. In 1997, that statute was amended. That statute no longer contains this requirement that it used to have. Rule 8104 is based on the prior version of Section 512.050.
Does your argument depend, this argument you're making just now, depend on your argument that adding a filing fee is substantive as opposed to procedural? Because this court has authority to add procedural requirements like file with the clerk, do it within so much time and so forth. That's our authority under the Constitution. Substantive changes in the right to appeal, we can't do. But if we think this filing fee is a procedural rather than a substantive requirement, is it still your argument that the statute specifically says, specifically bars us from making it a precondition to considering an appeal filed?
Your Honor, I don't know if I've taken a position, and I don't think I've ever thought of whether the filing fee is substantive rather than procedural. I think what I've tried to say, and if it's not clear, what I mean is that 512, all the court's cases say, or the few that talk about it, say that the right of appeal is purely statutory, mm-hmm. that nobody has a right to appeal unless it's in the statute. And Article 5, Section 5 says the right of appeal can't be restricted. To the extent that 8104 has been read to engraft onto 512.050 a requirement of a filing fee at a particular time in order to have a valid appeal that can go forward at all, respectfully, that is a restriction on your substantive right to appeal.
And you're saying that other defects in an appeal, you're entitled to notice in a hearing and an opportunity to correct, and you believe that should be true.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not saying that. 512.050 says any other thing that you do can be the basis for dismissal, but it's not appropriate to keep you out of court. And the court's own rules at 8408 says if you haven't done something, the court will give you notice. You can correct it. If you don't correct it, then you're out. That's entirely fair. Respectfully and applicable to Mr. Goldsby, who did everything he could do to pay this fee within the time. It wasn't filed by August 8. However, it was received shortly after, long before his appeal was dismissed for an untimely filing fee. So he satisfied the requirement. There's no dispute, and the requirement wasn't raised until well into the appeal. Under 512.050, under the state constitution, Mr. Goldsby's notice of appeal was timely, and it was improper to dismiss him on that point. And to the extent that there are tons of cases that say that filing the filing fee within the time for the notice of appeal is a jurisdictional requirement. Respectfully, under 050 and the state constitution, those cases should be reversed. Those should no longer be followed.
But you would say that they were accurate under the prior version of the statute.
Up to 1997, Judge Wilson? Yes, sir. That's 100% true. And I'm not. There are tons of cases that say that. We cite a case called CNF Investments, I think, which is a post-JCA case in which the Court of Appeals was dealing with the trial de novo statute, but apparently took a peek at the statute for the notice of appeal and said, boy, by the logic of JCA, that should still apply to appeals, but the cases all say that the filing fee timing is jurisdictional, and we're bound to follow the opinions of the Court of Appeals. And so I don't have any quarrel with the Court of Appeals having dismissed this. The cases of the Supreme Court, the Moore case that's cited by the respondent, the Kettering case upon which a lot of these cases rely, they all say it's jurisdictional and the appeal should be dismissed. To the extent the Court of Appeals followed them, Court of Appeals was following the Constitution as it was required. I'm saying that this court should set aside those cases and declare that they should no longer be followed. In the alternative, if I'm wrong about that, I don't believe I am, but if I'm wrong about that, an inmate appellant in this situation is no different than an inmate filing 2915 motion. 2915 says the inmate shall file his motion within a particular time, but this court has found properly that an inmate is unique in the civil system as a class of litigant because he or she does not control the method by which things get filed, et cetera. The undisputed facts show that Mr. Goldsby did everything he could do in order to get this filed within the time. Officials of the prison system, I'm not saying anybody did anything wrong. I'm saying that there was a delay. I'm not accusing anyone of anything, but that the delay was not caused by Mr. Goldsby. It was caused by what the Price case, the Watson case, might call the active interference of others.
How many days prior to the deadline for filing his notice of appeal did he request transfer of funds through the prison system?
Judge Breckenridge, the notice of appeal was due August 8. He requested it on July 28, just a couple of days after the denial of his post-judgment motion. So sooner than I probably would have been able to do it. Your Honor?
It was just one day after.
Yes, practically immediately. Mm-hmm. Say what you will about Mr. Goldsby, he's diligent with respect to filing deadlines. And I feel like 2915 and Watson and Price are pretty good for me because I didn't hear anything about them from the respondents in the respondent's substitute brief. And then finally, going to the merits of the thing before I had to sit down, I hear that principles of res judicata were invoked in the circuit court. Nobody in the circuit court said res judicata. Nobody set forth the standard for res judicata, which requires a final judgment on the merits, same parties, same facts. The Exhibit A to the motion to dismiss was an unpublished memorandum from the Court of Appeals in the Western District in a case called Goldsby against Crawford. That case was a declaratory judgment as to whether in 2009 Mr. Goldsby was entitled to be released. That is not the issue raised in his petition in this case. Exhibit B to the motion to dismiss was from a case called Goldsby against James Hurley from the Circuit Court of Pike County in 2014, another case, a habeas case, raising the issue as to whether Mr. Goldsby should have been released at that time. That is not the issue that's implicated by the petition in this case.
In deciding those cases, though, didn't the courts have to decide that he had no set release date because he was in prison for a life sentence?
The issue in those cases, Your Honor, was whether he was entitled to be released at that time, whether he had completed his sentence.
And in the course of deciding that, didn't they say no because he has a life sentence, so it has no end date in their case?
The unpublished memorandum does say that, Your Honor. However, that is, for purposes of res judicata, that is not the same issue that's raised in this case. And furthermore, those are not shown to have the involve the same parties. The parties have different names. If someone wanted to show me that those were in privy, they could do that, but there was no motion on res judicata.
So it's an affirmative defense and it wasn't raised below, you're saying?
Excuse me,
res judicata is an affirmative defense that was not raised below?
It is and it wasn't. That is correct.
They seem to be arguing, well, they didn't use the words res judicata, but they raise the concepts. Do you dispute that?
Your Honor, those are some pretty good lawyers, and they did not use the words res judicata, and I think I know why, because this is not barred by res judicata. Today, through the time that I'm standing here, the respondent has never said this is barred by res judicata, and here's the standard for res judicata, and here's how I met it. Never did it in the circuit court, never did it in the respondent's brief in this court. And so, Your Honor, when somebody doesn't tell me something, I assume it's for a reason. I will reserve the rest of my time.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Mr. Goldsby's appeal in this case was properly dismissed by the Missouri Court of Appeals because the issue that really is invoked in this case is what does the word filed mean? The statute talks about timely filing. But the statute also talks about a notice of appeal. And just as the statute does not define what a notice of appeal is, it delegates to this court to enact those policies and procedures. The statute does not define what the word filed means, because that's a procedural rule that this court can and has determined through its rules. And that's what the Kettering case is about. In Kettering,
but actually the statute does. It says you may file a notice of appeal, may appeal from a judgment or order by filing with the clerk of the trial court a notice of appeal. And you have to do it within 10 days, and it talks about the transcript, and it says, after a timely filing of such notice of appeal, failure of the appellant to take any of the further steps to secure review of the judgment or order appealed from does not affect the validity of the appeal, but is ground for such action as the appellate court deems appropriate, including dismissal. So why doesn't it say that anything but filing the notice of appeal is simply subject to motion to dismiss?
Because the statute is silent about what the word filed means. So the statute talks about things that occur after filing.
Actually, it says by filing with the clerk of the trial court a notice of appeal.
Right. And so what's being discussed here is sort of the difference between a lodged document, which in this case would be the piece of paper that is titled Notice of Appeal, which was transmitted to the clerk but not filed until such time as the filing fee accompanied that paper. In Kettering, this court talks about how in order to have properly filed a document, a Notice of Appeal in particular, you need two things, both the piece of paper that complies with the court's procedures, I think it's currently Form 8, as well as either a filing fee or a statement that the filer is not required to pay a filing fee or an order allowing you to proceed in.
How are we to interpret that the statute before 97 specifically required a filing fee and that was removed, but no change in the definition of notice of appeal was made?
Right, and that's an excellent point, that the language or the filing fee amount and the words filing fee were removed. But that's simply a delegation or a retreat by the General Assembly out of the sphere of procedural rules that this court's empowered under the Missouri Constitution to insert.
Isn't that inconsistent with your saying that the notice of appeal inherently includes filing fee?
It is not, Your Honor, because that's what this court talked about in Kattering, that the notice of appeal under, and Kattering relies both on the prior version of the statute and this court's prior rules in effect in 1950, which are substantially similar, although the wording has slightly changed to Rule 81 in this case.
The rule of statutory, statutory interpretation is that we give words their plain and ordinary meaning. And so are you asserting that the word plain and ordinary meaning of file includes you have to pay money to file?
In this case, Your Honor, the plain and ordinary meaning of the statute leaves to this court the ability to define what the word filed means, just as it leaves to this court the ability to define what qualifies as a notice of appeal. That's the state's position in this case. And that's consistent with the longstanding rule, at least beginning in Kattering and continuing through the present day.
Because of the age of the case, was it and did it analyze the issue and make its holding that you have to pay the filing fee at the time the statute required the payment of a filing fee?
Yes, based on this court's rule and the prior version of the statute. That's right. That's the holding of the case. And the case talks about the policy reason for that, which is that prior to the imposition of that statute and that rule, there was sort of appellate chaos where the litigants were in control of when a case would proceed on appeal. And in fact, the case speaks about the damage not only to the litigants who have the right to have their, you know, case finally resolved, but also to the courts and their ability to manage their appellate dockets. And that rationale is as true in 1950 as it is today.
Why isn't that served by treating the failure to file a filing fee like the other requirements for filing an appeal, filing a record, and so forth? You file a motion to dismiss, or the court asks why the case shouldn't be dismissed for failure to comply.
And two reasons for that, Your Honor. The first reason, which is expressly talked about in the Kattering case, is the sort of pressure release valve of the special order permitting a late notice of appeal. The second reason is the things that the court's been discussing here, the transcript, the legal file, those sort of things, those occur after the filing, right? So when an appeal has been filed, then you proceed to file the legal file as well as the briefs. And those are the things that the statute clearly say cannot impair the right to appeal.
Well, opposing counsel notes that you only have 6 months to file a special notice of appeal, and the state asked for an extension of time to file their brief and then file their brief after the 6 months and for the first time raised this issue. Should that factor into our decision?
It should not, Your Honor, because pro se litigants, like other litigants, are expected to follow the court's procedures. And that sort of ties in.
Does it affect our view of it as an available safety valve?
It does not, Your Honor, because it's still present. The procedure was still available to Mr. Goldsby, and he was on notice from the Circuit Court of Cole County about the filing fee requirement. So he could.
And he filed it by the 17th of August. I mean, he sent it in before the deadline. It was filed by the 17th. This isn't someone who waited 6 months to file their filing fee.
That's correct. But he could have requested a special order from the Court of Appeals for a late notice if he was concerned about his...
If he were concerned, exactly.
That's correct. He did make a mistake, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I think there's no doubt in the record about
that.
Can
you address his alternative argument that the rationale this court used in Price and other cases in saying where there's third-party interference and the defendant has done everything he can do to file timely, we'll consider it timely, where here he had to deliver it to the opposing party for filing and the opposing party delayed 2 weeks?
I can, Your Honor, but I push back just momentarily on the idea that the department delayed. The record is clear in this case that the department followed its policies and procedures for the issuance of the check. I would also point out that earlier in the Cole County appeal, when Mr. Goldsby was ordered to pay a partial filing fee, the department dispatched that check in response to the circuit court's order in 15 days. So the processing time for on the department's behalf here is actually faster for Mr. Goldsby than it was for the order from the Cole County Circuit Court. But as to the necessity of a safety valve, there is no late notice of appeal option for someone who has to file their 2915 or 2435 in the circuit court. They can't ask for a special order permitting a late notice of appeal.
Given the timing, was it possible at all for Mr. Goldsby to actually get his paperwork to the authorities of the Department of Corrections to actually get the fee in on time?
There is a way he could have done that, and that would have required him to have requested the filing fee during the pendency of his motion for reconsideration. And I can understand the policy concerns about asking a litigant to do that, but if he had pursued that option, then there would have been sufficient time.
But in effect, and I understand you understand that, he would be being asked to give up his right, in effect, filed a motion to modify. He had every right to anticipate it would be taken seriously by the court and might be granted.
That's
and
correct.
Yet, if he files his appeal, it cuts off.
Is that an authorized trial motion that would have given him the extra time or not in this type of case?
The motion to reconsider?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Your Honor. It was.
Within the 30 days.
But he could have lodged a notice of appeal early as well.
And doesn't that cut off the court's authority to act?
My understanding is that it does not.
It doesn't start your time to appeal till the 30 days is over, so the court controls. But it
right.
otherwise would cut off any additional time you might have to act immediately upon the 30 days.
That's correct.
So it would shorten his time for appeal.
Yes, if he had pre-lodged.
Now, your opponent says you never discussed Price and Watson, so I want to give you a chance to discuss Price and Watson.
Yes. So the rationale, the policy decision the court has made behind the third-party active interference doctrine is the recognition that this court's rules in 2915 and 2435 are harsh, they are firmly established and regularly followed, and there's a need sometimes to take into account sort of extraneous circumstances where, for instance, in one of the cases, the offender transmitted and relied on his attorney, or the mail was otherwise delayed, or the circuit clerk didn't process the paperwork in accordance with the timelines. But here, there's no need to adopt or extend that rule because of the special order for the late notice of appeal in the appellate courts. In many ways, that rule is actually more generous to litigants because it gives a 6-month window as opposed to the 2, 3, 4, 5 days that would typically be incorporated in, for instance, a prison mailbox filing or a situation in which the circuit clerk didn't properly file the paperwork or the warden didn't get the 2435 motion in the correct mailbox. So the court's actually adopted already a more generous standard in the context of a civil appeal. I would also suggest to the court that a civil appeal about jail time credit doesn't have the same constitutional dimensions that a collateral attack on the quality of trial counsel or direct appeal counsel or, in some cases, even the actual jurisdiction of a court to impose judgment. And so that's another sort of policy reason why. The special rule in Price and Watson would be properly cabined to post-conviction relief and not necessary to be expanded here.
Counsel, if the court were to hold that the notice of appeal is effective when received in the circuit court, even if it's received without the filing fee, do we know when this notice of appeal was received in the Cole County Circuit Court?
That information is not clear from the record, Your Honor, and the reason for that is because the circuit clerk followed this court's rules, which expressly prohibit the clerk from marking the document as filed.
But there's evidence when it was received.
There's evidence of when it was transmitted. Mr. Goldsby says that he sent the document on a certain day.
There's something about August 5th or so. I can't remember. There's something on the record about a particular day when it was.
August 6th would have been the deadline, and I think it's probably possible for the court to assume that that's when it was received, but the document was filed or file stamped on the 17th in accordance with the court's rules for when the filing fee was submitted.
Well, does the record show correspondence from the circuit clerk's office to him telling him that it's deficient?
That's correct, yes.
And what's the date of that?
I think that is probably the August 6th date, although I don't have that date.
And so is that prior to the filing period?
That would have been the last day of the notice of appeal period, including the additional days that someone receives.
So if they dated a notice that they sent to him saying we didn't get the money on a day that he could have filed it, then that's pretty good evidence that it was filed without the filing fee by that date.
And the term I would use, Your Honor, is lodged with the court, because in the department.
Well, that begs the question we're deciding here today.
Well, right, but I don't want to concede, obviously.
I'm sorry, I used the word filed.
Well, that's really what the case is about, is what constitutes a filing. That's what really cuts to the heart of the case. And this court's rules, the statutes don't control when a document is filed in this court or in any court. Filing is a procedural thing that this court is empowered by the Missouri Constitution to make that decision. In fact, if the General Assembly were to propagate rules about when documents were filed, nothing could stop would stop them, if that were proper, from propagating rules about what a point relied on must say, or what the word limits for a brief would say. Because those requirements, much like the requirement that a piece of paper that complies with the notice of appeal procedures and a filing fee be submitted together to qualify as a filing, is procedural.
Mr. McPherson argues that if, in fact, the court takes the position or continues with the position that you must have money filed at the time you file your notice of appeal, that the court in its rules is making a substantive change to the law because it is changing the nature of the right to appeal.
But it does not change the nature of the right to appeal, Your Honor. So those sort of procedural rules don't affect a litigant's ability to file a direct appeal from a declaratory judgment action. They still have the right to do that under the statute. I just briefly, in my last 15 seconds, want to touch upon one last thing, which is the distinction between a trial de novo and an appeal in this court. In one of the footnotes in the Webb case, this court points out that associate circuit courts are courts of jurisdiction that is limited and controlled by statute, but that circuit courts only have one type of jurisdiction, or two categories, because of the Missouri Constitution: personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction. So that's an additional reason why those cases that deal with the difference between jurisdictional requirements for trial de novo.
But they did cite the appeal statute, 512, in that decision.
They did, Your Honor. But I would suggest to the court that if the General Assembly purported to put an additional jurisdictional requirement on a circuit court's ability to hear a case, in addition to the requirements of personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction, like a filing fee, that would be inappropriate.
Webb would govern.
that's correct. But that's why the trial de novo cases are inapplicable to an appellate jurisdiction.
And I need you quickly, even though your time is up, so why are you arguing res judicata applies? Opposing counsel says you're not. Are you arguing it's collateral estoppel? And it's an affirmative defense. Did you raise it below?
Yes, Your Honor. As far as I understand, there's no requirement for that to be pled in the answer, although opposing counsel is correct that it was not pled in the
Normally
answer.
Normally it is. Are there cases saying you can do it?
There are cases that say it's proper to raise that in a motion to dismiss, which that concept was raised here. Collateral estoppel or res judicata do apply in this case.
But did you raise them by that name below, and if not, why is that okay? Address the argument made by Mr. McPherson.
I would agree with the point of the court that the department did not use the phrase res judicata or collateral estoppel, but those principles were invoked.
Why not? I mean, it's pretty basic principles if that's what they're arguing.
Your Honor, the principles were what was invoked. I did not file the motion to dismiss, so I can't answer for that individual attorney. I know there was some discussion about a party's name being different, but Mr. Hurley, and I can't remember the other individual, those are wardens of institutions. And they're going to be in privy with the Department of, with the director of the Department of Corrections, who was the named attorney, in, or I'm sorry, named respondent in this case. And you're exactly right, Your Honor, when you point out that it's necessary to determine in the prior cases whether Mr. Goldsby should be released. It was absolutely necessary, and it's a fact that's bound up in those cases with whether or not the sentence was calculated properly. And a life sentence is a life sentence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On the time that I have, I'd like to respond to a couple of questions from the bench. Judge Wilson, your question was, what's the record show? The record couldn't show any more clearly that this document was received by the circuit court on August 5th. If the court looks at the supplemental legal file at page 22, that's in the appendix to the substitute reply brief at 1, it's got the envelope by which it was transmitted, was received by the court, and file stamped August 5th. The notice of appeal is due by August 8th. Of even date with that on August.
It says received.
No, Your Honor. The envelope, the transmittal envelope, has a stamp that says filed on it from the Circuit Court of Cole County, August 5th. Also, on that same date, the circuit clerk, the lady whose job it is to file, lodge, receive these things, by letter dated August 5, she says, this office received your appeal on August 5. That's in the supplemental legal file at 33 in the appendix to the substitute reply brief at A2.
Well, Mike, yes, that's the available evidence in this case, but evidence is usually presented, evidence is rebutted, and somebody has to believe it or not believe it. My concern is that if we introduce a fact question here in an appellate court, the mechanism for deciding facts in an appellate court is at best ineffective, inefficient.
Is the fact question as to when this was submitted to the circuit court?
In this case, that's the fact.
Well,
because
Honor,
if we were to say that that's the date that matters for timeliness of a notice of appeal is not when the money is received, but when the notice is received, then somebody has to decide when the notice was received.
Well, Your Honor, I heard a minute ago that the statute doesn't define filed. This court's rules define filed. I was looking for it while you were talking with my worthy opponent, and there is a rule that says that a document is filed when it's received by the court, by the clerk. I'll find that, and I'll drop a note to the court if you don't.
And if we were to adopt a clear rule that you don't, I mean, we have a rule now that says you've got to file the notice of appeal and you have to file a filing fee, so if we dropped the requirement of the filing fee, it would be just as clear as it is now, wouldn't it? there's no problem now generally in determining when something is filed because it gets file stamped.
Well,
is when we're going to let the circuit clerk file stamp something.
I'm not aware of any other rule that this court has, like the portion of 8104 that says when this particular thing is filed, that the clerk will not note it as filed unless it's accompanied by a filing fee, a notice that you don't have to pay, or a motion to proceed IFP. I'm not aware of any other document that's treated that way, which I think is a consequence of the former version of 050, which seemed to include that requirement. I heard a second ago that the legislature retreated from the sphere of whether a fee is required. That's certainly not true. And in the respondent substitute brief, they make it clear that there is another statute. That provision for the payment of the fee was just moved to Chapter 488 when the legislature was cleaning up the filing fees. They took a bunch of filing fees out of the individual statutes and put them into one kind of omnibus filing fee statute. And so there still is a statute, and it draws a distinction. The statute always drew a distinction between the fee and the notice of appeal. This court's rules draw a distinction between the fee and the notice of appeal, and the statute only requires a notice of appeal. I apologize.
No, thank you for answering that. So your opponent argues that the active interference exception really shouldn't apply in this sense because the appellant had the opportunity to file for late notice of appeal. So can you respond to that?
I can respond to that, Your Honor, and that's the first response I've heard to anything about 2915 or the court's cases on it. What I heard was that there's no doubt that, quote, he did make a mistake. There is no doubt that he did not make a mistake. He did everything he could possibly do to get this filed.
But he could have filed a notice for late appeal with up to 6 months.
Well, he did. And, Your Honor, the reason that is not a way to comply with 050 and Article 5, Section 5, is that his appeal, this appeal, was dismissed because the filing fee was held to be jurisdictional, pursuant to this court's cases. He filed a motion under Rule 8107, which is not an appeal as of right. That is directed to the discretion of the Court of Appeals or this court in an appropriate instance. What I'm hearing is, if you lose your right to appeal, which is in the statute that everyone has, your appropriate remedy, your safety valve, is that you're a prisoner and you can file a motion in the Court of Appeals and it's directed entirely to the discretion of the court. That's it. That's all you get. And what he got in response to his was a one or two line order that says the motion is denied. That's it. That is not a discretionary motion to be filed with the court. Is not a safety valve for losing what is a substantive right of appeal.
Chief Justice, can I ask one additional question?
Sure.
Can you address real quickly this procedural argument? I mean, it seems to me if we wanted to enact a rule that says we will only accept a filing, a notice of appeal, electronically. I'm not saying it's a good policy decision, but what if we decided to do that? And the statute just says filed. Is your argument that if it's received by the clerk, not electronically, but in paper form, that the clerk would have to receive it and it would be a proper filing?
Your Honor, two things. The court can enact any procedural rules that it deems appropriate. That's a constitutional right and power that the court has, and I'm not saying it lacks it. What I'm saying is, to the extent that the court's rules limit a right that one has under the statutes or the Constitution, that rule might be improper as applied under the state constitution or the federal constitution. For example, if the court initiated a rule that all filings had to be electronic, then folks without means, folks who are in prison, might have no ability to comply. And the court's 2915 cases show that fair rules, evenly applied against everyone, need exceptions with respect to some folks who can't comply with them.
But there's no argument here that he didn't have the funds to make this filing fee. It's just whether or not he had the time to make it.
Whether he had the time to make them.
To pay it.
Well, it's not the time issue, Judge Powell, as much as it is the ability to do it. It's undisputed that, and as the circuit court recognizes, as the respondent recognizes, Mr. Goldsby doesn't have a checkbook. He doesn't have any money.
The ability within the time period.
And as soon as humanly possible, as soon as I could have done it, after he got the denial of his post-judgment motion, he requested the check and followed the procedures. Now, what I heard a little while ago is that the record is clear that the department followed its procedures. Respectfully, the record shows no such thing. The record is silent as to the department's procedures. In the appendix to the respondent's substitute brief, there are some regulations that are attached about how the Department of Corrections handles all of this prisoner money. That's not in the record. I didn't object because I took that to be a citation to authority, and that's appropriate to be included in an appendix. But there was no evidence in the circuit court of what the procedures were, who followed the procedures, and whether there was anything untoward here, whether there is no record in the circuit court that my client did anything other than
try. Now we're back to the fact question I raised earlier. Record in the circuit court when?
The record, I'm sorry, what?
When was this record that you're complaining wasn't made supposed to have been made? Because the debate is going on in the Court of Appeals.
It is, Your Honor.
So where was this hearing at which he was supposed to introduce this evidence?
Your Honor, I don't believe any hearing would have been required because what I heard a minute ago.
It's not possible. That's my point. It's not possible because the jurisdiction has now shifted up the road to Kansas City.
And, Your Honor, neither is it necessary. Because the statute says what you have to do to lodge an appeal and divest the circuit court of jurisdiction. That happened. There's no need to do any further record on that. The circuit clerk's record is very clear as to when she got this notice of appeal, and that's all that's required.
If the court had allowed it to be filed and struck it the next day without notice or opportunity to cure because the no filing fee had been filed, you're going to be arguing fairness or due process or some other, you know, that he was entitled to something more than to have it filed and dismissed. And again, That's going to raise fact questions, and I'm going to have masters in the Court of Appeals deciding these fact questions.
Well, I don't think you are, Your Honor, because you have cases on that. The JCA case says that if you comply, then it's not proper to dismiss you. There's a case that Judge Stiff wrote on the Court of Appeals called Harris against Munoz along the same lines. If you try to comply and you get dismissed, that's improper. But what we're talking about here is whether Mr. Goldsby did everything he could do. He certainly did. And what I heard from, with respect to discussion of the Kettering case, that a bright line rule is appropriate so that way we don't have any of these kinds of disputes. If the court were to strike the part of Rule 8104 about this in forma pauperis, no right to appeal, et cetera, if the court struck that, then the general rule that a filing is filed when it's received would apply to a notice of appeal and you would have the brightest line rule possible. The court sees plenty of disputes from time to time sees disputes about when something was filed, and the court is guided by what the file stamp says. The only reason this didn't have a file stamp on it on the day it was received was because of that portion of Rule 8104, which is contrary to the statute. The court would not have any fact issues or controversies. The court has been greatly indulgent with respect to the time, and I appreciate that. We would respectfully request that the dismissal be set aside, that the judgment of the circuit court should be reversed. Thank you.
Case will be submitted.